guys, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, today, honoring indigenous roots of democracy, Venus Uranus exactly conjoined, right? True equality, equality between humans and all of the rest of our kin. We remain our exercise of sucking the G out of kingdom and exhaling it to where that belongs, which is everywhere, leaving the kingdom of heaven is at hand. You know, so magnetizing egalitarian trickster medicine for dangerous, dodgy times. So more than perfectly welcome, longtime ally in perpetuity, backwards and forwards, Reverend Sarah Jolina Wolcott is a witchy minister and healer who sees origin stories as potent points for systemic change. A descendant of some of the founding fathers of the United States of America, her work of retelling her own family and national history has led her to perceive some big stories very differently. Prior to her current work, she engaged in climate change adaptation overseas, which led her to recognize the spiritual and cultural potentiality of regenerative cultures, leading her to study ecotheology at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York. After graduating seminary, she started Sequoia Samanvaya and teaches some of the art and practice of remembering and re-enchanting our place in the world. Her website is, her website is, what is your website, Sarah?
SequoiaSamanvaya.com.
Oh, that's great. Welcome, Sarah. Welcome, Sarah. There, we've done it. We've put some things on the table here. That's great. So I love it when we get tapped in just a little bit. I was talking to you last night, afternoon, and my power and internet had gone out in a spectacular fashion the night before. Just boom, boom, electric fire, the whole pour on fire, you know, raining plastic flaming bits, you know, onto everything, the bamboo and the no felons, more felines sign just vaporized. And anyway, so finally came in with that. And so I was talking to you and we got to some pertinent part and I go, whatever is truly best for everyone, come on in. And the power came on. So we love that call and response. And today I had to do some internet thing, like today, right? Like right now. And something before this and the Comcast guys show up. And I just want to say, you know, we would be nothing without our Hispanic ally citizens who know how to fix stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, anyway, I just went out and I go, can you do it? I'm going live on something or other. And he's like, I love this phrase. And I've heard it from other Hispanic allies in which they say, I've got you. It's like, I love that. I've got you. And it came on at the perfect time. Anyway, and I go, thank you forever. May you win the lottery. May all whom you love, love you. And he's like, back at you. Reciprocal blessing, right? Just weaving the day together through reciprocal blessings. So that was a small happy thing. Anyway, so here we are. I had written, you know, and we can go backwards and forwards, your splendid book. July 2nd, 1776 was the day that the Continental Congress voted for independence. Mm-hmm. The day that we celebrate, July 4th, was the day that Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence. And according to my ally, Jerome McGeorge, he's pretty reliable. He said July 2nd is when the indigenous of the Onondaga and Iroquois peoples gave the go-ahead to the founding fathers to proceed with the Declaration of Independence. I don't know. I like it. If it's not true, we can make it true, right? So guide me. You wanted to go further back.
Backwards and around about a little bit through time and kind of talk about some of the stuff. First, I think it's like just worth saying, like, as you mentioned, like when I'm talking about these histories, I'm talking about like my forefathers, my ancestors, my family members. I did not grow up. My family did not teach me. I knew that the Wolcotts were amongst, like, I mean, several of the families were amongst the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And I knew that they were there at that time. And it was just, you know, always a really important part of my family history. I had no clue that whilst Oliver Wolcott and many of the other, like, much more well-known signers of the Declaration were in Philadelphia during the Continental Congress, that they were surrounded by their indigenous friends and colleagues, and sometimes not so great friends. And that in particular, many members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, which sometimes at the time were referred to as the Iroquois, which is a French term.
Okay. And can you say the Haudenosaunee?
Yeah, Haudenosaunee.
Say it and spell it.
Haudenosaunee.
Haudenosaunee. Thank you.
Yeah. And so, like, there's several spellings because, of course, like, you know, it has to get translated into, like, the English alphabet from a completely different language, the Iroquoian language group. But it's usually Haudenosaunee. Shoni. Yeah.
Yeah,
not
beautiful.
Related to the Shoshone.
Yeah.
different group, different language group. And so the Haudenosaunee tradition confederacy, so it's six nations. At the time it was five nations, around that time it was five nations. It's this big group, right? And it's in the northeast. It would have traditionally gone across what's now the western part of New York. And it would have gone into the Mohawks would be in Albany. And so there's like five to six nations. The Tuscarora as a later came up kind of in the midst of the 1700s and joined their long lost siblings. That's a whole story in and of itself. That's for another time. And so it's a confederacy. It was these different nations had come together into this confederacy. And they call Haudenosaunee, loosely as translates, means people of the longhouse. So I didn't know, I had no clue that, I didn't even know who they were. I think I roughly maybe heard about the Iroquois somewhere in my high school textbooks, maybe. I think I did. And maybe that they influenced something somewhere, but I didn't know very much. And I certainly didn't know the extent to which on the eve of the American independence, that there were so many Haudenosaunee people who were literally witnessing, watching, and supporting in what we now think of as the halls of Congress in the Continental Congress. And that they were strongly encouraging the what they call the 13 fires, what we call the 13 colonies, to unify and come together as one. And so, like, when you look at that famous image of the American eagle, it's holding these 13 arrows, which symbolize the 13 colonies. And that's like part of the emblem of the United States of America. And that symbol of the holding of the 13 arrows is an indigenous symbol. It is particularly a Haudenosaunee symbol. And one of the things that happened after the ratification is that George Washington and his peers paraded on their horses through the streets, and everyone held up the 13 arrows. They had bundles of arrows that they held up and paraded down the streets, showing that they were unified. And that symbol of unification, that symbol of those arrows, which is embedded in, like, you know,
the Great Seal and all.
In the Great Seal, which is on, like, you know, trucks all across the United States right now, is that's an indigenous, and particularly Haudenosaunee, that's an indigenous symbol, right?
And I'm just on Graeber. I'll toss it back to you in a second here. David Graeber, may he be praised forever, in the Democracy Project, it says the Six Nations, the Federation of the Iroquois Onondaga ambassador proposed, not the myth of Western civilization. And he holds up one arrow and goes, look, easy to break. Six arrows, difficult to break, right? And the white settlers go, oh, good idea, bundle of arrows, 13 arrows, there we go, hard to break. That leadership could come from group fellowship and alliance, very important.
Yes, the leadership comes from alliance, that's the point. And that we are stronger together than we are separate.
Yes.
Right, and this is a very indigenous way of teaching, like this very clear, direct, tangible symbol. And real, like it's a real metaphor, like it's real, like the arrow is a real thing. And it's also like symbolic of a much bigger thing. So, you know, I didn't know any of that stuff. I didn't know anything I just said. And In my own journey to try to understand the origins of climate change, which I at the time thought of as a totally unrelated topic, I came to understand the importance of the doctrine of Christian discovery. And that led me into a journey of unlearning and learning from Indigenous colleagues across America, but in particular, the members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And that led to many kind of long relationships in which they helped me learn my own story. They helped me know my own history in a different lens. And it's like, so these Indigenous roots, this is part of my story and is part of our collective story. And everything that I've learned and everything that I'm sharing is freely available to the public. This is not secret knowledge. And it's been said by Indigenous elders for, you know, decades and decades and decades. And usually when I teach about this, I teach about it with my partner, Christine Hill, who is a member of the Tuscarora Nation, which is part of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And today she had to attend to family and she had to actually attend to a bunch of family things. So she has to pay attention to her own people this week.
Yeah. And then just remind us, we know doctrine of discovery, boo. What is it?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So the doctrine of Christian discovery is what we currently call a set of documents. There's a set of papal bulls. Papal bulls were written by the Pope in the late 1400s and early, most of this was in mid 1400s, late 1400s. The first one was 1453. I teach about this stuff, so I know some of these dates, which otherwise I wouldn't. There's a first one is leads to the perpetual enslavement of the people from Africa. Of West Africa. That's particularly what's written in this bull. It leads to the quote unquote discovery of what we now think of as West Africa. There's a lot of complex things in that. Europeans certainly were aware of Africa's presence before then. But it's a papal bull written by the Pope that's imposing a particular imagination of dominance and subjugation and slavery and enslavement and the dominance of the Christian peoples over non-Christian peoples all over the world, regardless of whether or not those they had ever been known or recognized or whether or not, regardless of their own agency. Yeah, so it's saying that because of their Christian faith, they have superiority over all these other religions and places and lands. And I can go into the kind of theology of that, like how that came to be. But just like for this conversation, like, so the first one had to do with Africa and the second bull, it had to do with the Americas. It was right after Columbus came back from Turtle Island, what he called the New World. There's a set of papal bulls that subsequently become codified in first European law and then subsequently much later into American law. It's part of a Supreme Court justice case in the 1800s that basically denies Indigenous peoples' land rights and puts all the emphasis and continues this cultural superiority and says that people from Europe have ownership over the land in America, what we now call America.
And then just part of our frame as we all, hello, everybody listening, citizens. So Pluto gives us a giant composting cauldron, and soon it will have retrograded back where it is. It's now at 3+ Aquarius, which is restoring a lost condition of spirituality to the world. And then in a couple of days, it goes back to 2+ Aquarius, which is deserter from the military following their own wilderness path. And I think that's a great blessing to waft out and for everybody to go deserter from orthodoxy, deserter from colonialism, deserter from, you know, any of that. So the doctrine of discovery into the cauldron, right? Into the composting cauldron. Is that we're up for that, right?
Yes, please.
Right. And I do think that, you know, for our horrific convenience, every quality of our rogue species is in full play now. As Dante says, hell is empty, all the demons are here. But everything really terrible, you know, the violence, the cruelty, the corruption, just this bill, the bill that just past that is shameful. You know, it's all, everything from human history that's nefarious. Well, we'll get to the good stuff too, but it's here. So it's in a way, it's like a convenient package going all of that into the cauldron, empire, you know, and yeah, the complexity of what you bring and Chrissy to the table too. And David Graeber, you both have Mars in Cancer, which is a wonderful thing. It's history. you know, knowing history is great. And I can't help but quote the wonderful Wag, you know, we know those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. Who adds, those who suppress the teaching of history intend to repeat it. We go, right. So knowing it is really important. So yeah, so we get to throw things in and it is all evident, the horror. And that includes, you know, all the things that we've been conditioned to love about empire, which is, you know, there's culture and Mayan empire, exquisite, you know, and really cool. But it is a hereditary priesthood that sucks all the resources into the ruling class. So it's like, you know, and, you know, Egypt, great stuff, great, but pyramids and slaves. So do you feel that we're in an opportune time in accord with yourself and David Graeber and, you know, Chrissy to go, let's compost empire. You know, let's work with.
I wish. I hope so. Oh, I mean, no, yeah. Are we in a time for it? You know, it feels like empire is growing stronger, right? It feels like you look at the news, like it looks, you know, like someone was saying to me the other day, well, almost everything that the colonists were angry with King George about, like, if we go through that list, you could say some pretty similar things today about a current president. Like, and the extent to which the executive power has, you know, there's a reason there's these no king's protests. Like, it's not right. Like, and it's terrifying to watch, right? So like, and I don't want to deny, right? We can't deny what's happening. We can't fall away from that. And yet in this time when so much is being dismantled, like, it is definitely rich with the opportunity to reconfigure and to reconfigure who we are and to reconfigure what might become and to put things into that cauldron that are being dismantled and bubble up something different.
Right, to ladle out the new old desirable vision based on historically informed originating impulse now. That's what's being kind of proffered to us. There's a very beautiful symmetry to the astromytho dance now, but it behooves us, all of us, to animate in a desirable way, lest we leave it by default to the dementors who are very good at hoovering things. So we're moving into a time where messages, you know, it's like greased lightning. So whatever message one has is like, so let us craft the desirable message, the invitation to a better story. Unless the Peter Thiels and the Palantirs are like, you know, information hoovering of everything. So, yeah. And then you wanted to go further.
And that's part of why these histories are so important. That's part of why understanding that there are indigenous roots to democracy is so critical right now. It's so critical to remember that and to, because then it helps us see that, oh, actually building alliances with indigenous people is what America was in some ways born to be able to do. Like, we've learned from our elder brothers. And of course we also have taken active role in hurting and harming and some cases destroying them. And yet, like, that kinship is still there and we are still capable. We still have the possibility, at least, of being in better relationship with them and with all of life on earth. Like, that possibility is always before us.
Right. And I just, you know, weave in David Graeber again too. He has his homage to pirates as an anarchist community. That's a whole other book and a whole other wonderful thing. But the frontier communities, intercultural experiment, settlers and indigenous people. He says, you know, when the Puritans first came here, they were like appalled, going, do you know that the native people do not beat their children or their wives? How uncivilized, that's revolting. But some of the settlers were like, we kind of like that. This idea of equality, I'll toss that back to yourself. we want to be more like Indians, and the people who were called Americans were the first people to be called Americans were indigenous people called Americans by the early settlers who liked what they were up to.
Right. Everyone in Europe understood that when you said American, you meant indigenous people, because that's who
great.
Was in America. Like,
let's bring that back. Yeah.
It's pretty basic. Yeah. You know, you're mentioning Wegener and The Dawn of Everything, A New History of Humanity. And the first part of that book does such a beautiful job. Like the rest of the books, the rest of it's good too, right? But the first part of that book does such a beautiful job of helping to retell some of these stories. And as I said earlier, like indigenous folks have been saying this for a long time, like none of this is new, but he kind of pulls the pieces together in a way that's been reasonably accessible. It's a very thick book, quite good. So I actually had to read a little beautiful section from it. So first of all, just to situate where we're talking about, the 1600s in missionaries and colonists, particularly through Canada, like southeastern Canada, northeastern United States, around the Great Lakes region. Both colonists and missionaries were exploring, they were missionizing, they were meeting all these people who they had very little knowledge of. And the indigenous people who they met, some of them were great philosophers, and they critiqued European society. And they studied and analyzed it. Some of them traveled to Europe, sometimes by force, sometimes by choice. And they critiqued the society that they saw there. And they're extraordinarily critical of what they saw. And there's just so many amazing quotes on this. So like, here's just one example. Yeah. The Mi'kmaq consider themselves better than the French, for they say, "You are always fighting and quarreling among yourselves, yet we live peaceably. You are envious and are all the time slandering each other. You are thieves and deceivers. You are covetous and neither generous nor kind. As for us, if we have a morsel of bread, we share it with our neighbor." They say these things to us. In this case, the narrator is a Jesuit, continuously. The French may have had more material possessions than Mi'kmaq conceded, but the Mi'kmaq had other greater assets: ease, comfort, and time.
Wherever you want to go, I've just got my finger in the pages here. Yeah,
I was just gonna like another great quote, right? And this is in 1642, and Jesuit missionary says, wrote of the Montagna Nascapi, a different group. Like they're talking about different indigenous groups, but the critique is this very, very, very similar throughout the different group, throughout the different tribes and nations. So this is about liberty. They say. This is a Jesuit speaking. They imagine that they, the people of the Montagna Nascapi, ought by right of birth to enjoy the liberty of wild as colts, rendering no homage to anyone whomsoever, except when they like. They have reproached me 100 times because we fear our captains, while they laugh at and make sport of theirs. All the authority that the chief has is in his tongue's end. He is only as powerful so far as he is eloquent, which is code for there is no state violence and state police, and no one's going to go after you if you say disapproving things to your leader. And so like, there's just like these volumes and volumes of these critiques of European society as being unequal, as being unjust, as being too authoritarian, as being hierarchical. And then if I may, this is from Graeber and Wegener, like their own narration. Not only did indigenous Americans confronted with strange foreigners gradually develop their own consistent critique of European institutions, but these critiques came to be taken very seriously in Europe itself. Just how serious it is can hardly be overstated for European audiences. The indigenous critique would come as a shock to the system, revealing possibilities for human emancipation that, once disclosed, could hardly be ignored. The ideas expressed in that critique came to be perceived as such a menace to the fabric of European society that an entire body of theory was called into being. Specifically to refute them, our standard historical meta-narrative about the ambivalent progress of human civilization, where freedoms are lost as societies grow bigger and more complex, was invented largely for the purpose of neutralizing the threat of the indigenous critique. The first thing to emphasize is that the origin of social inequality is not a problem that would have made sense to anyone in the Middle Ages of Europe. Ranks and hierarchies were assumed to have existed from the very beginning. It is not the medieval thinkers rejected the notion of social equality. The idea that it might exist seems never to have occurred to them in the first place. The terms of equality and inequality only begin to enter common currency in the early 17th century under the influence of natural law theory, and natural law theory in turn arose largely in the course of debates about the moral and legal implications of Europe's encounters in the New World.
Okay, we're going to do Graeber poker. I see you, Graeber, and raise you one. I mean, it's in accord, really. All right, just that, just to stress what you just said, the noting that the Jesuits were opposed to freedom in principle. Mm. Yep. The Jesuit relations are full of this sort of thing, right? So yeah, this is really important. Tracking everything back to its suppressed, originating, liberating impulse and setting it free, right? So he says the Jesuit relations are full of this sort of thing. Scandalized missionaries frequently reported that American, meaning indigenous women, were considered to have full control over their bodies. Ah, outrageous. And that therefore unmarried women had sexual liberty and married women could divorce at will. This was an outrage to the Jesuits, right? Such sinful conduct, right? And goes on like that. And then he goes, in which we show how Europeans learned from Native Americans about the connection between reasoned debate, right? I love this, personal freedom and the refusal of arbitrary power, right? So indigenous are teaching these honkies, right? And it's very important. It's a crucial thing, for us to honor. And then, you know, again, I've just have, you know, random things, but it's also really great. Oh, wait. Oh, look, I see. Haudenosaunee. Say it again.
Haudenosaunee.
Thank you. Mm. Haudenosaunee. Oh, that's right. We need you narrating this book. but there is, you know, because, you know, and then, you know, his great, you know, Kandirak. So there were Native American deep thinkers who went to Europe, right? And reported back going, these civilized people, it's not civilized at all. The passage you read too. And I love their confident critique. Kandirak is criticizing the extraordinary self-importance of the Jesuit conviction, you know, about this and that, you know, and then these ideas of eternal damnation, you know, and it's like, and Kandirak's just going, it's just you silly honky people, right? So we're still composting that, and the no kings thing is crucial. It's crucial. We have another wonderful No King song for our break music. Because you know, when Churchill and American CIA and oil interests overthrew Iranian democracy twice, once was in 1923, complex, there was a coup, but it was egalitarian. And again, women were equal. Women were equal in Iran. They had equal rights and equal woofiness and could dress as they pleased, right? And Churchill was like, no, we need the oil. We'll overthrow that. Then in 1953, they overthrow Mossadegh, democratically elected, right? And again, it's Gulf oil, Kermit Roosevelt, CIA, imposing a king. Mm. Imposing a king on democracy. So this is a really important, just for everybody, just right. Mm-hmm. Imposing kingship,
right?
So, yeah,
and yeah, it's like we still haven't quite learned this, right? That we can be free without kings. So, still seems to be a challenge for us to figure out. So by the 1700s, like America is known as a land, like the phrase, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Like that's a The brave is a term that was often used to refer to particularly indigenous warriors, Indian warriors, as they were called. Mm-hmm. And like that's those phrases are referring to, like, they knew that these people were free. The women were free, the men were free, and they were independent. Like, they, so many of those early descriptions talk about their dignity and their fierce independence, and they are lords. You know, no one is their lord. And and they admired this, even as they consistently were, you know, taking their land and their food and burning their homes.
We're going to take our musical break, but it fits right in. It fits right in with what you're saying. It's a song that we played last week from an ally who found me and sent it to me on Facebook, FNS Henderson. But it's really good, especially after this horrific bill just passed. We'll suck the chi out of it. So here's this musical song that fits right in with what our wonderful guest Sarah Walcott is saying, and with backup from David Graeber and Indigenous Wise People. So here we go. No Kings.
They cut the cords that held us close,
but we still stand.
They fired folks, they broke their oaths,
but we still stand.
Stripped the aid, took the care, cut the lights, said life ain't fair.
We still here, we still rise. Ain't no king above our
lives. They try to write our freedom out the law books, erase our names, our pride, and our looks. But we're the heartbeat under every street, and we won't bow, we won't retreat. No king,
no king,
no crown,
no crown,
no crown,
no crown,
no
crown,
no thrones to tell us to sit down.
We rise up,
we rise,
we speak out. Ain't no king gonna steal our shout.
Her job.
To every brother denied the care. To every grandma without her meds.
We still care. We still care.
To the ones they fired from the bed. Cut off dreams, left justice dead. You are not alone. You are not erased. We bring your memory into this space. We ain't marching just for show.
Oh, I love that song. Every time I hear it. Thank you. Thank you, FNS. You'll teach me how to pronounce your name, FNS Henderson, our ally in the Pacific Northwest. But isn't that great?
Yes.
No kings,
I
no
love
fear.
It.
We're here. You know,
this year.
We're here. Yeah, and I also noticed that, as a friend pointed out, the great funk tribute, and that it's smoking. You can dance to it. It's powerful. We're here. It's a proclamation. No kings, no fear. You know, we're here. We're still here, and caring. Let's go into protection and safety and wherever you want to go, and history. But just to have that fill the gatherings, right? Just that, you know, I see throngs of people doing, you know, dancing to that.
Yes,
it's really strong. So thank you, FNS Henderson, for this wonderful song that gets better every time I listen to it. Okay. So that's in keeping with our woofiness. Our guest is Sarah Wolcott, and Sequoia Samanvaya is her website. There you go, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank
Which
you.
no one can. It's like, yeah, don't start an organization with a name that no one can pronounce. But it means coming into harmony with ancient living wisdom.
Oh, of course.
And yeah, so it's very much what I'm trying to do. And as I say that, I'm reminded of, there's always this question of where do you start the story, right? And where you start origin stories. And as we're talking about freedom, independence, and how America was understood, it's like all of that freedom and that independence comes out of a culture. And I think that my forefathers, my ancestors, in many ways completely missed this part, that it comes out of a culture that, one of the great indigenous scholars, Paula Gunn Allen, talks about this as cosmogonies that are feminine-centered deities. In the case of Haudenosaunee Confederacy, it's Sky Woman. That the stories and the cosmologies are centering mother or grandmother Earth and the moon, and they're centering the cycles of life, and they're centering the harmony of creation. And not to say all indigenous societies everywhere, I'm not trying to say that, but by and large, the creation stories from these lands and the energy and the movement in these lands and waters are ones that remember, and the stories the people today uphold and the dances that the peoples today uphold. These deeply like sacred, that's honoring the sacred feminine and the dance between the feminine and the masculine.
And Sky Woman also exists in Lakota, right?
I don't
Yeah.
know much about Lakota stories. I know that Anishinaabe,
Well, let me just
and
do this
yeah.
little brief homage to Bob Goff, who was the lawyer for the Lakota Sioux and did many great things. And he was talking to NASA again, this weaving between indigenous and science, as going, "No, you're really agreeing." But and he said to NASA, "You know, there are people keeping history. You know, you're studying, you know, geological cycles of climate catastrophe and he do, but there are people who are living storytellers and keepers of history in Lakota, and they have a story to, they really know." So he got them together. He got NASA and Lakota storytellers together, and they told the story of Sky Woman. And Sky Woman goes to the sky, you know, with Sky Guy, and she's has a vegetable garden in the sky, and her vegetable garden is in the bucket of the Milky Way, and one day she pulls a giant turnip out of the center of her garden in the Milky Way, leaving a giant black hole through which she sees the Earth and yearns for it. And NASA said, "Well, that's really interesting because we just discovered a black hole right there." Anyway,
Wow.
so again, yes,
Wow.
again, history is a myth, myth is history, and science and myth are really in accord. But anyway, now back to you. So that was a brief report from Sky Woman everywhere. Yeah, so that's great.
It's in, these stories of going, how do we go from one world to another world, right? And many creation stories are telling how you go from how you go from one world to another world, and how you birth into another world. And the sky, there's many variations of the Sky Woman story. I haven't, it's so cool to hear that one. So like that's a piece of what's, there's a deep interdependence from which independence can arise. And like that's part of this, there's all this ways in which women and the earth and sacred feminine is centered, but not in like a dominant way, but in a way of reciprocity, and everyone has a role and a place kind of way. That's how I've been taught, at least. And I think my ancestors missed that part when they were looking at the independence, when they were looking at the dignity, and when they were looking at the lack of aristocracy and the lack of authoritarianism around them. They didn't, I don't know what they saw or cared to see or tried to see, like the deeper cosmovisions underneath them, underneath that, that enabled all those things to arise. And the power of women and also the and non-binary peoples that allowed that to, that was present, right? And it was sorely missing. But then to kind of jump forward again to 1700s, we have the sort of the classic story of the Boston Tea Party, in which people board a bunch of colonists or settlers board a boat, a British boat, and throw off the tea. But they're dressed as Mohawks.
Right.
They're dressed as Indians. And in his book, Phil, the lovely book for those of you who are like reading about these things, called Playing Indian by Philip DeLoyer, who's an Indigenous scholar. Mm-hmm. And he kind of he goes very deeply into the symbolism and the meaning of what it meant for them to paint their faces and go onto these boats and overthrow the sugar and the tea, and which are such complete symbols of both slavery and colonization the world over, right? Like already it was a global economy at that time that was like just incredibly damaging to people around the world, that the colonists were in some ways benefiting from, in many ways benefiting from. And of course, obviously at that time, 20% of the peoples in the colonies were enslaved Africans. So in no way was this an equal system. In dressing as Indians, and the colonists dressing as Indians, they were showing themselves to be Americans. And they were showing that they were no longer Europeans. They were no longer Englishmen. So there's this symbolic thing that's happening there, in which they're self-identifying themselves as non-British.
So you're viewing that as a kind of positive, cool thing.
So the reading, is it positive? Huh, that's interesting. I think it was powerful at the time. I don't know that it was,
so it wasn't positive? It wasn't to fool, it was to become.
Yes, maybe a bit of both. I mean, foolery and becoming are related. I don't, like, you know, when I hear these stories from, you know, Faith Keeper, Orin Lyons from Onondaga Nation, and Philip DeLoria, and like these other Indigenous scholars, when I hear them tell these stories, I don't actually, that one in particular, I don't hear them saying it was so much good or bad, mm-hmm. so much as them saying, recognize the power of the symbol, and that they were, your ancestors were trying to become like us because they thought that we were free and they knew they were not.
Like, yes.
Like they're trying to get into the potency of the symbolism of it.
Right. Yeah. Very different from the first 9/11 in this country, where the Mormons dressed up as Indians, as Native Americans, and massacred the settlers, saying, you can go get water. We're just kidding. We're going to kill you all.
The subsequent histories of people dressing up as Indians is really, really kind of weird and often very, very, very disturbing.
Right.
And sometimes liberatory, I think occasionally once in a while, but often just disturbing and weird.
And I just want to bring up just again to and fro the Condé Aranc, who I think also went to Europe. Well, he did, because he's commenting on it. Yeah, and he's debating a Jesuit. Excuse me. He says wonderful thing. I mean, anyway, I find it hard to see, Condé Aranc says, how you could be much more miserable than you already are. What kind of human, what species of creature must Europeans be that they have to be forced to do good and only refrain from evil because of fear of punishment? Because the Jesuits are like, you must punish people and kill them. And oh, you know. And I just want to repeat this because it's so satisfying. I find it hard to see, said Condé Aranc, how you could be much more miserable than you already are. You Europeans, what kind of human, what species of creature must Europeans be that they have to be forced to do good and only refrain from evil because of fear of punishment? You go, Condé Aranc, you go. And then he says, I have spent 6 years reflecting on the state of European society, and I still can't think of a single way they act that's not inhuman. And I genuinely think that this can only be the case as long as you stick to your distinctions of mine and thine. I affirm that what you call money is the devil of devils, the tyrant of the French. I mean, it's so refreshing. Let's go back to honor these guys, right? It's the source of all evil, the bane of souls and slaughterhouse of the living. To imagine one can live in the country of money and preserve one's soul is like imagining one could preserve one's life at the bottom of a lake. And he goes on. Anyways, just deeply satisfying. Like, yes, we're rooted. Well, it's deeply satisfying, right? And again, I mean, yourself and wonderful Chrissy and David Graeber, it's like really bringing this up so that we know it, going, oh, yeah, smart debate. Because when we were talking also, you know, freedom, equality, independence, you said those were Europe, like, you have to excuse my notes here, not European, but indigenous qualities, freedom, equality, independence. Is that right?
That's my new understanding of these histories. I mean, I always like to have things subject to change, but, and like definitely the extent to which people were free here, you know, like that was not, and the notion of equality, you know, the extent to which they saw, the European settlers saw a level of freedom and dignity and equality and unity as well, and independence and welcoming and happiness that I don't think they really saw. Like, those were not values that they might have, like, they were there in their own, some of their own texts, and they were certainly, like, in the stories of Greece, particularly, you know, Greek democracies, there were stories of that there, but they weren't seeing living examples, and they except in the Americas, and they were, so it shifted Europe. I think those values changed, those American values changed Europe, and it, of course, obviously shifts the people who were living in what we now call America, and they kind of wanted in some ways to become more like their indigenous neighbors, but they were also deeply embedded in the doctrine of discovery and deeply embedded in a particular form of Christian superiority. Not all Christianity needs to be superior, obviously, right? Like, I very much enjoy working with a lot of Christian texts and religious communities and people. This is not bashing Christians. But it's just like what there is this, there, you know, when Christianity becomes the religion of empire, like the way in which that was imposed upon this land and their own worldview, they were still often treating their indigenous neighbors and hosts and the people for whom they relied upon for their very existence really horrifically, even as they were learning from them. It's a very complex, they're saying multiple things and they're self-contradicting themselves, very much so. Like, the colonists were very self-contradictory in how they related to indigenous peoples,
right?
Who, without whom they like literally could not have survived. Like, not just in the 1600s, but their continued existence on that continent would not have happened had it not been for indigenous folks.
And you were mentioning Benjamin Franklin's.
Yes, he plays a huge role in this.
With the Mohawks. Yeah, well, guide us into Ben Franklin's connection to the Mohawks and the Seneca and the Onondaga.
Right. So, as I mentioned before, like, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, you know, the six nations of the Confederacy is a Mohawk that's on the most eastern. That's so the Albany, what we know as Albany, is the Mohawk territory. Oneida, Onondaga is in the center, it's a center fire. Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora. So there were multiple, like, and it's these conversations I think were happening over generations, right? But certainly during the time of the founding fathers, such as Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, they were in conversation with many indigenous leaders, but in particular, you know, naming a few names who we don't hear of very often, you know, Chief Conestatego from the Onondaga Nation, a man who's now often referred to today as Corn Planter from the Seneca Nation, Chief Tayanoga, sometimes known as Chief Hendrick from the Mohawk Nation. These were all gathering around the colonists, these founding fathers, and were in conversation for a long time. And so, like, you know, we have at least in 1744, Chief Conestatego from Onondaga suggests unity amongst the colonists. Franklin hears this talk and he takes that idea seriously and he begins to try to, but the other colonists don't take it particularly seriously, and it takes another two decades for the colonists to come together. In 1753, there was a treaty in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, where the Oneida chief, Skowyadi, talks about the friendship between their ancestors and the importance of mutuality and kinship and brotherhood. And they exchange wampum belts. And Franklin's learning from these people as he goes, and he's learning their diplomatic language. The language of wampum belts is a diplomatic language.
Because you'd mentioned that Washington also made a wampum belt.
Yeah.
And remind
Wait,
us
first
what,
of all, I should pause. Do you know what a wampum belt is?
No, that's what I'm asking you.
Oh, okay, great.
Tell us, what is a wampum belt?
Right. So when I first was learning about this material is such a weak word for this, for these beautifully exciting histories, I got the opportunity, incredible opportunity, to go to Six Nations in Canada, Six Nations Polytechnic, which is the one of the primary Haudenosaunee reservations in Canada, is on this, not so far, it's just a little bit away from Niagara. I took the train from Niagara in New York. Hmm. And they were doing what they call like repolishing the Silver Covenant chain, and refreshing the two-row wampum belt, which was a treaty between the Dutch and the Haudenosaunee in the 1607. So like the first treaty between a European power and the indigenous people was called the two-row wampum. It's a very important wampum belt. So, and they would bring out these wampum belts. So the wampum belts would vary in size. They may be like, I don't know, like they set 6 or 3 to 6 inches across. And some of them are very long. Some of them are not very long. And wampum is shell. Wampum is made, there's these little beads made from shells. So they have all the energy of the ocean in them and the lakes. And they're found on the seashore. And you can walk many places today and find the shells, and they're purple and white shells. And then they grind them and craft them into these belts, into beads. And then the beads are strung together into belts and all sorts of other things.
The wampum belts are for wearing?
This is a really interesting question. So we often translate the belts as treaties, as agreements between the people. So they embed the belts with different designs. Uh-huh. They weave the design through a combination of purple and white shells, beads. And sometimes they're a mixture, but usually they're kind of either purple or white. And they create these different patterns and designs in these wampum belts. And you can do many things with wampum. You can have wampum jewelry, you can have like decorative things. Sometimes people would use them for various forms of trade. Sometimes they remind me a little bit of some other like cowrie shells in terms of like their multiplicity mm-hmm. of their use. They have a sacred use, and they also like are part of trade and their ornamentation. They have like, these are like these shells have many different uses, right? But when I saw, in this case, it was Rick Hill, who's an amazing scholar from Tuscarora in Canada. He's a wampum scholar. I mean, he's a scholar of many things, but he's done a lot of work recovering wampum belts from rematriating wampum belts back to be held by the nations. That when he holds this belt, it was the way he was looking at it and speaking to it, and the way, there was a reverence in the way he held it. That it's not the way I see people holding most treaties or holding most pieces of paper. Mm. It reminded me much more of the way I might see a rabbi hold the Torah, right? Or an imam hold the Quran. There was this reverence in the holding and in the reading. And it was like he was listening to what the belt was telling him. The belt had an animacy to it. And the shell spoke to him of what his ancestors had woven into them. And the women often in council meetings will sit at the, like they'll listen to everything that's being said in the council meetings, and they remember it all. They're called the rememberers. One of the women's role in that community is to remember, is to remember. And their capacity for remembering, I can tell you from personal experience, is just unbelievably incredible and sometimes terrifying. They remember everything. And like they remember so many layers of the stories over many generations of how these, what the belt meant and how it shifted and how it, the meanings shifted and changed and evolved and the different stories that were told around
so,
it.
So when you say that Washington had his own wampum belt, what does that mean?
Well, part of what that means is that he understood the diplomatic language of the Indian nations that surrounded him.
And he had one. I mean, he had one.
He created one.
He created one.
He spent
one. Oh,
the time.
Wow.
And these things take for, like, this is, these are little tiny, tiny beads, right? Like little shells. This is very difficult to do.
Ah.
And it takes a lot of time. So when he created, it's called the George Washington belt, and you can find lots of images of it online. But when he created that belt, or an agreement as part of a treaty agreement, he made it by hand. I mean, like that's the story. I mean, I don't know, maybe he had someone make it for him, but they say they he made it himself.
That's so perfect. Because, you know, again, I always use this, when Hercules is destroying the world and behaving badly, the gods get together and they sentence him to go to the underworld to learn knitting and weaving, to weave together the fabric of creation they'd been sundering. So Washington beating is a great image.
Totally.
You know, that's just really great. We're in our final,
we'll have to do
part two here. Right?
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, like a couple years later, just to make sure we don't lift up Washington more than he deserves. A couple years later, after these belts are exchanged, he goes and does this, what's called the Sullivan campaign, and completely wipes out like this, some Seneca villages and tribes. And it was like a burnt earth classic Roman imperial campaign. And he got the nickname, the Haudenosaunee, the word is translated into as town destroyer. And so they have called every president since then. One of the words that I hear them use is, there's many words, but one of them is town destroyer.
But Washington, you know, complex guy, he told the enslaved people, if you fight for the revolution, we will set you free. And then afterwards he goes, just kidding.
Yep.
Anyway, so we're all too soon, but we should do a part two because we need to get to so much of what you and Chrissy know, the peacemaker and the power of grief.
We didn't even get to the grief.
And feeding the grieving, I know, but we're on our way. We have to leave people
ancestors.
with their own grief. And the ancestors, right? Can the ancestors help us? And you said the animist world can help us. Thank you. Thank you. We will do more. We will do more. This is all important work. Thank you so much, Sarah Walcott.
Thank you.
Website, Sequoia Saman Vaya. You can find it. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. Thank you. I'm Caroline Casey. You can find us on Patreon, Visionary Activist Show, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you. Woof, 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 woof.
Woof, woof.
Woof, 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 woof.
Oh, yeah, get it.